This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPB Online.org. MPB Think Radio.
From MPB Think Radio, this is Money Talks. I'm Kevin Farrell with Chris Burford and Nancy Lotfridge Anderson. We all want to have as much control as we can over our assets to make sure there's a little something to hand down to the next generation. Today, we're joined by elder law attorney Richard Courtney, who will answer your questions about asset protection. Give us a call at 1-877-MPB-RING, which is 877-672-7464, with questions about how to protect your home, retirement accounts, and other assets. Or you can email us a question to money@mpbonline.org. You're listening to Money Talks from MPB Think Radio. On MPB Think Radio, I'm Kevin Farrell, joined by Chris Burford, the Community Outreach Coordinator at Consumer Credit Counseling Service of Jackson, and Nancy Lotridge Anderson, who's president of the investment management firm New Perspectives Incorporated, and also assistant professor of finance at Mississippi College. This morning, our guest is elder law attorney Rick Courtney from Frescona Courtney, PLLC. If you have not heard Rick on our program before, you're in for a treat. He does a really good job, very knowledgeable about his subject area, and also what I think is important, helps explain legal terms in words and phrases that people down to my level can even understand. So, Rick, we're glad to have you here this morning.
We're always glad to see Rick, except Rick is in his blue jeans today. Oh, what's up with that?
I've got to fly to a conference this afternoon. So.
Oh, a lot of fun then.
It's a travel day.
If you have a question today about asset protection, you can call us at 877-MPB-RING, 877-672-7464. Our email address is money@mpbonline.org. If you're a Twitter user, you can follow MPB Talkers. And also, I think our web stream is working. If you'd like to see what Rick is going to be flying in today, you can tune in at mpbonline.org. So, again, if you've got a question, the main way to get in touch, 877-MPB-RING, 877-672-7464. Rick, I'm going to start out fairly easily. When we talk about asset protection, what are we protecting? What assets are we talking about?
Well, we get the question a lot, and it usually comes in the context of long-term care thinking. In the elder law world, we have adult children or spouses of ill parent, older people calling saying, how can we save our assets or mom's assets from the nursing home? That's sort of the stock phrase we hear a lot. But there are other asset protection things that others that aren't in the older years of life need to be aware of, and we're protecting our home, we're protecting our financial resources, and we're protecting those things from certain things. That's usually the questions I'll start with. Well, what are you trying to protect? What is it that you have? Mm-hmm. Okay, we look at the finances, at the resources like homes or land that may be inherited land and they really don't want to lose it. And then what are we trying to protect it from? Is it creditors? Is it external sources of influence like, well, my son, if he's a nice guy, but if he gets some money, he's got a gambling problem, or he's got he's on his second or third marriage and he has ex-spouses that are coming after money for support a lot, or he's got a high risk profession. He may get sued and not have enough insurance, and that whatever assets I leave to him may be exposed to his risks. So they can be forces that are out there that he doesn't control, and mom or dad are trying to protect his share of the inheritance from those things that are his creditors and predators, we call it. So it's what are you trying to protect? What do you have? And then what are you trying to protect that from? What are those risks that you see? For house, you know, we think, okay, I need to protect my house. If it burns down, I can rebuild it. That's insurance. So we can talk about some types of insurance, long-term care insurance to protect money assets from the costs of long-term care if I need to go into a nursing home for a long time. Okay, I can protect my money assets by having long-term care insurance. Or if I need to protect my bank accounts and financial assets from a potential automobile accident, I need a lot of automobile insurance. Get those limits up. So there are various things. And the state law also provides us some protections people don't often think about in exemptions. They provide a number of different exemptions of property assets from the claims of creditors.
And I guess that's an idea of just giving someone the basic necessities in order to continue to live. But let's talk a little bit about what are some of the assets then that are protected from creditors and who gets that protection.
Right. I'll talk about the exemptions in state law for a moment because one of those that everybody seems to be pretty familiar with is homestead exemption. Well, can somebody take my house? You know, in this economic downturn time, people may be losing jobs. They may have some debts that go unpaid. They may have a collection lawsuit and a judgment against them and a fear of a garnishment or somebody's going to take my house. Well, state law provides that every householder in Mississippi has a $75,000 exemption on the equity in their home. That is, if I own a home that's worth $100,000 and I owe less than, if I owe more than $25,000 on it, then my equity is less than $75,000. And the state law says if I have a judgment against me, they can get a judgment lien against the property. There is a judgment there, and I can't sell the property without paying that off, but the creditor can't take my house.
But a creditor that has that you're using the house for collateral, such as a mortgage, they can take the house, right?
That's right. The mortgage or deed of trust, when you buy a house and borrow the money, you sign a deed of trust. And I've always told people the simple legal phrase to remember about what that document means is if you don't pay, you don't stay.
That's a good
okay.
one, yes.
So if you default, the bank can repossess the house. They can foreclose and sell the property to get their money back.
So you're just talking about other creditors, because I hear these horror stories from these collection agencies who, I'm sure it's not legal, who call and tell people if you don't pay your credit card bill that we can take these other things, like your house. And you're saying, no, they can't.
Well, that's right. They can't violate these protections that are in the law, the exemptions of property.
Mm-hmm.
There's another exemption of $10,000 of any property you designate. And in my early law practice, I would say 75% of my practice was collection work with my father. And we represented banks and collection agencies and credit card companies. And we had several times we got a judgment against someone and we started to go and seize a bank account. And their lawyer would call and say, we're designating that bank account as exempt under this personal property exemption. At that moment, we had to back away and we said, okay, we can't. They're claiming it exempt. We can't get it.
So a bank account, you could say $10,000 in that bank account, you cannot touch.
That's right. You can designate that. Household goods, motor vehicles, and some other things like that. Then there are some other, IRAs under our state law are not attachable or garnishable. Mm-hmm. So,
another reason to contribute to that 401k, right?
Yes, that's right. Yes. Or 403b or 457 deferred compensation plans. I mean, those retirement plans have some protection in state law against seizure by creditors. So up to $10,000 of life insurance benefits that you're to receive. So there are a number of those in the Mississippi Code, the statute laws, and if someone has some fear that their creditors are coming after things, they need to consult a lawyer who can look in the code and say, all right, let's look at what your assets are, and let's see what exemptions protect you that we can just tell the creditor, you got to go away because mm-hmm. you can't get that. Then work with the other risks that are really out there.
And again, I guess that's to make sure that everybody has at least the basic necessities in order to live off of.
That's right. The state didn't want people to be destitute because they got into some financial struggle. So,
and then there's no way you can get out, right?
That's right.
We're on Money Talks today, talking with Rick Courtney, an elder law attorney, about asset protection. If you have a question for us, both if maybe if you're dealing with an elder parent or thinking ahead to when you get into your golden years, you can call us with a question today, 877-MPB-RING. That's 877-672-7464. Our email address, money@mpbonline.org. So if you're currently in good health, living alone, what can you do to protect assets, like you said earlier, from, say, a nursing home?
If you're in good health, and again, let me go back to that statement we hear a lot. Well, how can I save mom's or how can I save my assets from the nursing home? I want to often ask the person who's asking the question, are you planning to go to a nursing home anytime soon? We have a lot of healthy people come in asking, how can we save our assets from the nursing home? When what they may need is just good estate planning and good financial counsel as how to manage their money. Because they look healthy. I say, are you planning to go to a nursing home anytime soon? Well, no, not really. Well, let's don't let that be the primary focus right now. But how to protect assets from nursing home. Medicaid rules tightened up in 2006 and planning to protect those assets to get Medicaid eligibility. That's usually what's behind that question. How can we get Medicaid to pay the moms or my father's nursing home bill. For a single person to be eligible for Medicaid, you have to have less than $4,000 of countable assets. That's usually the problem. What are countable assets? Well, it's clear. It's everything but the non-countable assets. Now, everybody understand what I'm talking about? The non-countable assets are your house, up to $500,000 of equity, is exempt. Medicaid doesn't count it, your cars, your household contents and furnishings. If you are receiving required distributions from an IRA, people over 70 and a half have to start doing that by tax law, then your IRA does not count as an asset. It's a non-countable resource. So when you take those non-countable assets and set them aside, what you have left, checking accounts, CDs, mutual funds, investment accounts, stocks, bonds, savings bonds, non-residence land, all of that is countable assets. If it's more than $4,000, the individual is not eligible for Medicaid help. So how do you get below $4,000? Well, one way is spending down. You can spend the assets until you've got less than $4,000. Private pay your way until you're below $4,000. That's the way most people, and that's the way the Medicaid laws really want it to work. Well, can I give my assets to my son or daughter and get below $4,000 real quick and get on Medicaid? Well, no, because Medicaid has a rule that says we don't let folks give away assets just to make us pay their medical bills to a nursing home. So how do we enforce that? Well, we're going to say Medicaid won't pay the nursing home for the amount of time that the assets the person gave away would have paid for that care. Okay? And they only look at the assets given away during a certain period, and that's called a look-back period. From the day you file an application for Medicaid, they look back 5 years at gifts that you've made. Okay? You can buy assets and sell assets. That's not a problem. But if you gave assets away and got nothing in return, that's the problem. So let's say we'll get to the numbers on that right after the break maybe, and I'll finish that little explanation. But they look at whatever you gave away during the last 5 years before you apply, and they divide that by a figure, a number, to say how many months you're not going to be eligible for Medicaid to make a payment to your nursing home.
Rick Courtney is our guest on Money Talks today. We're talking about asset protection. Sue is on the line from South Jackson. We'll get to her question and more after this break.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPB. mpbonline.org. MPB Think Radio. Think Radio.
And you're listening to Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kevin Farrell with Chris Burford and Nancy Lottridge Anderson. Our guest today, Richard Courtney, an elder law attorney. We're talking about asset protection. If you have a question for Rick, you can call 877-MPB-RING, which is 877-672-7464. Send an email to money@mpbonline.org. And if you're a Twitter user, you can follow us at MPB Talkers, and we'll see if we can get your tweet on the air if you would send one in this today. Rick, before the break, we were talking about, eligibility for Medicaid and assets and that sort of thing. And we're kind of in the middle of a discussion there about, you can, what was it, $4,000 is the amount?
Yeah, what I was explaining was the transfer rule policy of Medicaid. If you give away assets within 5 years before you file a Medicaid application, you have to disclose that on the application that you've given away some assets. Medicaid says the average rate, that monthly rate that those assets would have paid for your care is $4,600. That's the rate that's in effect now. So if my mother gave me $46,000, she gave, turned a CD over to me or wrote me a check or deeded some land worth $46,000 to me 3 years ago, and now she files a Medicaid application, she has to disclose that. And the Medicaid office says $46,000 given away divided by 4,600, that's the, what they said it would have cost per month for those assets to pay my her care. That's 10 months. They will not pay her nursing home bill for 10 months following the time she files the application. That period starts running when you're in a nursing home and file an application. So some folks that ask, well, I can't give away assets and then get on Medicaid within 5 years, that's basically true now. You have to do the gifting more than 5 years ahead of time. Well, as we were talking during the break, and Nancy and I were saying, but folks may say, well, I want to go ahead and give some assets away to my children now so I can get on nursing home Medicaid more than 5 years from now. Is that a smart thing to do? Not many cases.
When because you, especially if you have more than one child, and there can be issues with disagreements there, and one child that ends up saying, well, I'll give them back to mom, and the other one says, no, mine are gone.
That's right. One thing about a gift is it's gone. You no longer control it. Okay. If you have any control over it, you're still, by Medicaid policies, considered to be the owner. So you've got to give it away. Well, now it's the kid's money. They can do whatever they want to with it. If they feel moral obligation to save it and take care of your needs later, if you need that, that's great. But there's nothing legally compelling them to do that.
Is there some difference when you're talking about an elderly couple and you've got one of them in the nursing home and one of them still at home? What are the differences there in how assets are treated?
It's a great question. There are significant differences in what we just described about transfer penalties. First of all, Medicaid does not impose any penalty for transfers of assets between spouses. Mm-hmm. So when one spouse goes in a nursing home, that spouse cannot have more than $4,000 of countable assets in his name. We'll just say it's the man who goes in the nursing home. So they can transfer all of his assets over to mom. Okay,
who's and do at home, that immediately.
Still home. Yes, and do that immediately. And Medicaid will even allow you to do that after you file the application to get that transfer complete. But now mom, if mom has a different limit called spousal impoverishment rules, they don't want her to be impoverished, so she can have up to $109,560 of countable assets plus any amount of those non-countable things we went over earlier. And dad can still be eligible. Mm-hmm. So she's got that higher limit. So when a couple has less than $113,000 of countable assets, mm-hmm. we just pretty much put $3,500 in dad's name and the rest in mom's name, and dad is now eligible for Medicaid. Mm-hmm. Okay? That's their rules and their numbers. If there are more assets than that, then there's some planning that can still be done legally. Under Medicaid rules, for mom to get her assets below that $109,000 figure for the time when the application is filed. It's a snapshot of that month. If you do planning, like I say, that's still legal and ethical for mom to do, her assets, her countable assets, can be brought below the $109,000 limit, you file the Medicaid application. Dad's now eligible if they stay in those limits for the rest of that calendar month. After Dad is eligible for Medicaid, the community spouse, mom at home, can acquire any additional assets without affecting his eligibility. Mm-hmm. She can inherit money from a family member. She can hit the jackpot at the casino. You know, so her acquiring more assets after the spouse in the nursing home's on Medicaid will not affect his eligibility. He stays on the Medicaid program, but she has more assets to take care of her needs.
Right.
Let's go to the phones for our first call. We are on Money Talks today, talking with Rick Courtney, an elder law attorney, about asset protection. Our number is 877-MPB-RING, 877-672-7464. Our first call is from South Jackson. Sue is on the line. Sue, go ahead with your question, please.
Yes, I have a question about a will that has a trust set up for an adult child, and the adult child has two children, 18 and 20, soon to be 19 and 21, and now the ex-spouse is coming after that trust. Is she entitled to that?
Good question. Trusts are very useful in a lot of different planning situations and asset protection situations. I'm going to say it depends on the language in the trust. Okay. Most trusts that we do like that, where a parent in their will sets up a trust for their child, they may do it to protect those funds from an ex-spouse of that child and to make sure the child gets the benefit of the money and then his children, the grandchildren of that will maker. Those trusts should have in them what are called spendthrift protections, which means that the child who is the beneficiary of this trust does not have the right to assign or to pledge that trust, those trust assets, to anybody. He can't pledge them as a gambling debt payment. He can't pledge them to the bank. It was mom's money, and he has no control over who gets it, she says in the trust. So spendthrift clauses are important in trusts like that. And it really depends on the language of the trust. If it's inartfully worded or loosely worded, it could be that a third party like that beneficiary's ex-spouse could have some access to it. Now, let me point out, in divorce and domestic law, which is not my strong suit, but assets in a trust, even though the ex-spouse can't get them by law, they may be unavailable to her. She won't get a share of the trust. The court, in a divorce or domestic support obligation situation, can consider those assets as being the beneficiary, you know, spouse's property in dividing up other assets. They can say, well, he's got these other resources in that trust, so we're going to give her more of this other stuff. And that can be the way it's weighed by the court.
So I guess you're saying for Sue to maybe go ahead and look back at the trust and look at the exact terms of the trust, and that might answer her question?
Right, yes. It all goes down to having a lawyer look at the trust and make sure what the particular attack on that trust is asking for and see if the trust itself provides the protection.
Okay. We do have the spendthrift clause in there, and the grandmother left prepaid college for both children and several thousand dollars in money market for, like, room and board and books.
I would think that that trust is probably not accessible to the ex-spouse.
But ex-spouse, as part of the divorce agreement, has to pay for a portion of the education? Can then that spouse come back and say, but this is already provided for?
Certainly they can say that, and would probably say that to the divorce court judge and say, this is already taken care of. I should be relieved of that obligation.
Right.
So those assets now, they're not more exposed than grandma wanted them to be exposed. She already said, we're going to set that aside for education. So you're still fulfilling what she said, even though you're letting someone else off the hook for that.
Right, exactly.
You know, Richard, I keep hearing, this kind of what's running through my mind, that as young, middle-aged, older, as you continue to build assets, you really need to sit down and talk to financial planners or honestly, attorneys, and dealing with assets or trust and stuff like that, because this can get really complicated, can't it?
It sure can, and I had clients in this week, older couple and their son, who's a financial pretty astute guy, and they said, well, we don't need really complicated, we don't need anything but simple wills because we got everything jointly owned, you know, mom and dad in joint ownership, and then we've got POD on our check, on our CDs, and that's basically what they had in savings was CDs, and so they said, well, if both of us die, then it goes POD to our children, you know, like outside probate. And I said, well, that's fine, but what if one of you goes into nursing home care? You're going to have to change that joint ownership if you want to try to get the advantage of Medicaid's, you know, larger exemption for mom, because you've got to get the assets out of the name of that person. And these were folks who were really concerned at an advanced age, I might say, mm-hmm. about their health care needs. They were seeing the risk as being the costs of health care.
And that's what I'm hearing more and more, Rick. And from my clients, it doesn't matter how much you've accumulated. There is still that fear and that anxiety about it's not going to be enough. You're talking about $4,600 a month for nursing home care that's being allowed right now by Medicaid. But that number is going up every
day. That's just the number that Medicaid uses to do that math to determine how long the ineligibility would be if you gave stuff away. As you probably know from talking to clients, the actual cost of most nursing homes now is about $6,000 a month.
And that is stunning.
It is. So people do need to plan. How are we going to take care of protecting what we've got and making sure we get the benefits as long we're living longer, but maybe the market downturns have given us less now than we had before.
Right.
So we're really worried about that. Sure, it's a big thing. And long-term care insurance is a reason a lot of people, are adult children now, are looking at that.
Let's go back to the phones for another call. Eddie has called in from Jackson. Eddie, go ahead with your question, please.
Thank you. I was curious, when the attorneys, when you're advising your clients and doing Medicaid planning, if you ever broach the subject to them of using their assets to take care of themselves as opposed to planning on becoming a burden to the other taxpayers in this country for us to have to see to their nursing home care?
That's a great question. And, yes, we do in our practice. I mean, the law's tightened up. Medicaid budgets are tight everywhere. Medicaid rules are tightening up. And I always tell folks, here are the ways you can pay for long-term care. Number one is private pay. Anybody can use their assets and pay their way as long as they have the money to do it. And then you haven't given assets away, and if you run out of money before you run out of life, you have Medicaid there as a backup. When you get into the Medicaid world with an application and into Medicaid, you're in that bureaucracy, and there are some things people just don't like about being in.
Well,
in
that, not every nursing home will take Medicaid patients. Isn't that correct?
That's right. Most of them do. There are only two full nursing homes here in the Jackson area that are private pay only. There's a rehab center in Brandon that doesn't take Medicaid. They're just rehab nursing homes.
But will that change?
It may. Who knows what the medical system and healthcare system will be 1 year from now, much less 5 or 10 years from now.
And I know, Rick, I'm under certain guidelines in my business about being very cautious about what I recommend to folks. And we've even heard of cases of federal agents who come in to federal investment advisors. And if we advise this giving away, that we can be prosecuted for fraud against the federal government.
Well, there were what are called granny goes to jail and then granny's advisor goes to jail rulings back in Congress back several years ago during the Clinton administration. But those, they've said, no, we're not going to impose any penalty against any advisor who advises somebody what the law allows. If you give legal advice, then, I mean, and I'm not talking about as a lawyer, if you give advice that is legal, how can you be prosecuted for that? But it is a very touchy area.
Mm-hmm,
and
absolutely.
I often tell people that question, how do we save mama's assets from the nursing home, usually can be turned around, well, son or daughter, or is your main concern not having to pay mom or dad's care yourself? Yeah, that's my real fear. Well, let mom pay her own way as long as she's got the money to do it. You're not coming out of pocket with that. And then the government may chip in when she no longer has the assets. That's a good question.
We're talking with Rick Courtney today on Money Talks about asset protection. 877-MPB-RING is our phone number. If you want to call us, it's 877-672-7000. 7464. We'll be back after this break.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPBOnline.org. MPB Think Radio.
You're listening to Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. I'm Kevin Farrell with Chris Burford, the Community Outreach Coordinator at Consumer Credit Counseling Service in Jackson, Nancy Lottridge-Anderson, Assistant Professor of Finance at Mississippi College and President of the investment firm New Perspectives. Our guest this morning, Rick Courtney, an elder law attorney and a partner in Frescona & Courtney. We're talking this morning about ways to protect your assets. If you have a question for us, you can call us at 877-MPB-RING. It's 877-672-7464. Or you can send an email to money@mpbonline.org. And that's exactly what Charlie did today. His email reads, "My name has been on my parents' bank accounts and CDs as a co-owner for many years, more than a decade. They no longer own a home, and all their limited assets are in bank accounts and CDs. They're both in their 90s, but very good health for their age. Will this protect the accounts from Medicare or Medicaid if they're placed in a nursing home and need help with their fees in the future?"
The answer is no, it won't protect those assets from Medicaid. Medicare does not care how much assets you have. That's a true entitlement program for medical costs. You've paid for it during your work life, like insurance, so you get it when you're over 65. But Medicaid is more of the welfare model. You get it because you have low income and low assets. Medicaid's rules about counting assets are this. If an individual has a joint account with a spouse named on there, a married couple, like my bank account with my wife, Medicaid would say half of that account is mine, half is hers. If I file a Medicaid application, they say half of the account balance is my assets, countable. So that's what you have to look at in determining whether I'm below $4,000 or not and whether she's above the $109,000 or not. If an individual has a joint account with a non-spouse, the non-spouse is disregarded by Medicaid, and Medicaid says those funds are 100% the funds of the Medicaid applicant. Okay,
you're hurting yourself then, is what you're saying?
No, he said his parents are both in good health in their 90s, and they have a joint account. Well, that's not a bad thing, because if one passed away, the other is the owner of the money without a probate, so that's one good thing, no paying lawyers and court fees to do a probate. But if that second parent now needs to go into nursing home care, the whole balance of the account is considered owned by the parent. They disregard the non-spouse son for accounting purposes, and so it's all of theirs. And while it's in joint ownership, those funds are countable.
We're on Money Talks today talking to Rick Courtney about asset protection. One thing that you had mentioned earlier, and I think this goes back to the question that Chris asked, and the idea of estate planning, and that's, I guess, preparing for things as you get older, before you get older. And so what if someone was interested about maybe thinking about estate planning, what are the ways to get started? What are the things to be thinking about?
Well, you want to get a good lawyer who understands estate planning. I think that's at least my position. As well as good financial planners who can look at how your assets are structured for growth and for income that you need. But you need to look at your property ownership. How do I own assets? One thing, talking about asset protection, is, well, I just put my daughter on, she lives close by and I'm kind of needing some help, and I'll just put my daughter on my account, like Charlie had, and so that she can write checks. She's got access to the money.
And that's very common that they do that.
Right. Yeah. People, no brainer. I'll just put my children on my account. Or I'll get mom to put me on her account, and that way I can write checks. Well, yes, you've now put another owner on those funds. Does your daughter have a high-risk profession? Does she have a judgments out there, unpaid bills? Is she a good financial? All of her risks now are attached to your account when you do that. So put joint owners carefully on accounts with you.
Yeah, my mother just occasionally puts a card under my nose and says, "Sign it."
Yeah, that's right.
You know, and you don't tell her no.
That's right. That's right. So property ownership is one thing. I have had, for instance, a lady said, well, I just need a simple will because my daughter locally is on my account. She can pay bills for me if I get down. I said, how many children do you have? Oh, I got three daughters. One's in California, but she's never really been close to the family. And the other one's in Tennessee and my daughter here. Okay, well, who at your death, Ms. Jones, who do you want to have mm-hmm. your assets? Oh, all three of them.
Right.
I love them all equally. I said, does your daughter in California get along well with your daughter here that you've put on the accounts with you? Oh, no, they don't get along. I said, well, at your death, your daughter here, who's the joint owner with you, will own that money. No legal obligation to share it with
and
anybody.
And in fact, sharing it is a complication when you're talking about gift tax issues.
Well, it could be for the daughter here. If she's well off and she doesn't need gift tax problems, it could be. So, and Ms. Jones says, oh, well, that doesn't sound good because I don't want to create a family feud after my
right.
death by what I've done. I said, well, here's another option. You can put your daughter here on your checking account as an authorized signer only. Tell the bank you don't want her as a joint owner, but as an authorized signer so she can sign checks. Okay, she can still drain the bank account if she's got a bad attitude, but she's got access. But other assets take her name off and say those assets will go through my will and a probate, and my will says I leave everything to my daughters in equal shares. That way that probate and court enforcement will make it flow the way she really wants.
Well, isn't it just better to have a power of attorney? Because what most people want is one child who can handle their business affairs if they reach the point that they can't do it on their own.
That's right. Powers of attorney are very important as management vehicles. We're five times more likely, anybody of any age listening to this program, you're five times more likely to become incapacitated through a disability than you are to die in any period you want to pick in the future, next five, the next 15 or 20 years. So I need to take care of how things will be managed if I become disabled, and that's a power of attorney. Another way to do that is a revocable trust, living trust that a lot of people do. It's a will substitute. It's a different way to leave assets that how they'll be taken care of at death. But the living trust can appoint a successor trustee, a child who's going to step in if some event happens, and you can designate in the trust, well, if my children all sign a statement that I'm unable to manage my affairs, then I will be pulled out as trustee and my son will be in as trustee, and now he will be the controller of my assets. The kind of control that a trustee has is stronger than the kind of influence a power of attorney agent has mm-hmm. in some situations. So it depends on the personal family dynamics and assets.
Which can be really tricky, Rick.
For everybody, it's a different book.
We've got a couple calls holding, but first, if you could, Rick, just a quick clarification again between Medicare and Medicaid.
Medicare is that insurance for paying medical bills that the government said when you've paid into the system, paid Medicare taxes for a number of quarters over your work life, then when you turn 65, you will become eligible for Medicare. Bill Gates will get Medicare when he turns 65.
I'm just hoping I live long enough to qualify.
That's right. That's right. Or if you become disabled and start drawing Social Security disability, then you 2 years after your disability starts, you become eligible for Medicare. My 30-year-old daughter has Medicare because she has Social Security disability. And she's got her Medicare Part D prescription drug plan, just like my mother does. Mm-hmm. So that's there. That's an entitlement. If you've paid enough in, you get it when you become eligible under their rules. Medicaid is the other program to pay medical bills. They don't send you a check. They pay your medical providers. And that's for people with low income and low assets who fit within one of their Medicaid groups.
And I believe, from what I've heard, Rick, that about half of Medicaid payments go to nursing homes.
That's about right, yes.
Let's go back to the phones for another call. Gail has called in from Biloxi. Gail, go ahead, please.
Yes, I have a question. I don't quite know how to handle this. My father, he's 85 years old. He owns his own home. He's already on Medicaid and Medicare, but he doesn't want to liquidate his assets. He doesn't want to do anything with them, and I heard you say that there's a five-year rule. So I'm trying to figure out if we even if we place him in a nursing home and we put the house up for sale, it's probably not going to move fast. It's in a very slow area anyway. So what are the rules as far as trying to sell it, or do they just figure out how much you assets that he would have and then prorate that per month and then pick it up after that, or how that happen?
You said that he's on Medicare and Medicaid already?
Yes.
And then you said if you put him in a nursing home, he's not in a nursing home yet?
No, but he's looking close to it.
Okay. He may be on a Medicaid program that pays the Medicare Part B premium every month. It's called a Qualified Medicare Beneficiary, a QMB Medicaid. There are different Medicaid groups. And if that's the case, his assets don't count for that program. They don't care how much your assets are. They care how much your income is. But let's go forward with your question. If he goes into a nursing home and you apply for nursing home Medicaid, that's the one where he can't have more than $4,000 of countable assets, but his house doesn't count. He can own that house, be on Medicaid, paying the nursing home. If he sells the house while he still owns it, he turns that non-countable equity in the house into countable cash. So now he's got more than $4,000 of cash. You have to report that to the Medicaid office. They kick him off Medicaid, and he uses that cash to spend down.
But that only happens when the house is sold, right?
That's correct, not before. And so when he gets the money from the closing of the house, that's when he now has received money, and he has to private pay that. In most cases, I wouldn't know if there were other planning options without looking at the specifics, but he spends it down to $4,000 again. Then he goes back on Medicaid because he doesn't have the money any longer or the house.
Go ahead.
Well, at his death, if he's on Medicaid in a nursing home and he dies and owns the house in his name only, if it's in his name only on the deed, Medicaid has another set of rules called the estate recovery policies. That says, people have said, well, I heard that they took grandma's house after she died. Yes, they can, because Medicaid is a creditor. They can't put liens on property while he's living. So they won't put a lien on his house while he's living. But at his death, whatever they've paid to the nursing home is a debt he owes Medicaid. And Medicaid is, by law, required to try to get their money back. If the only asset he owns in his estate is the house, they can say, like any other creditor, we want the house sold to pay us back.
All right, Gail, thanks for your call today. This is Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. Going to take our final break of the hour, but we'll be back with more discussion after this.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPB Online.org. MPB Think Radio.
Welcome back to Money Talks on MPB Think Radio. Kevin Farrell here with Chris Burford and Nancy Lotford-Janderson. And today our guest is Rick Courtney, a certified elder law attorney. He's been helping us understand a little bit more about asset protection. We've got two calls on the line. I think we should be able to get to both of these before we wrap up our show today. First, go to Clinton. Ann is on the line with a question. Ann, go ahead, please.
Good morning. This has to do with when a trust is initially set up. And if the money that is used to be put in that trust is owned by both spouses, should a divorce occur, does one spouse dominate over the other, or do they both still are qualified to receive funds or benefits from that fund?
Are you asking, are in that situation, are the spouses you're talking about both the beneficiaries of the trust?
That we don't know.
Because every trust...
My question is, if the money is owned to start the trust by both spouses, can one be disqualified?
Well, let me see if I can respond to that. When every trust has three different relation parties in it, is think of it as a triangle, and on each tip of that triangle there's somebody that's got a role to play. The people funding and creating the trust are called the grantors, and that seems to be who you're talking about. Spouses are funding and establishing a trust. Then they're going to give that money or those assets to somebody else. The second party is called the trustee. The trustee is the person or the bank who's going to manage those funds and invest them and distribute them for the benefit of the third party in this relationship, and that's the beneficiary or beneficiaries. It could be all my grandkids, or it could be my son. And that beneficiary is the one who's entitled to either income distributions from the trust or principal distributions or both during some whatever period of time over whatever kind of distribution you put in the trust. So if two spouses create the trust as grantors, they fund that trust, that they're done then. They don't, unless it's a revocable trust and they can each revoke it and take that money back. In a divorce situation, I suppose a judge could say, well, each of you could get half the money back if y'all revoke the trust, so I'm going to count it as half available to each. But usually if you're putting it in the hands of somebody else as trustee and it's an irrevocable trust, then that means the grantors who created the trust can't get it back. They've given that money away now to be administered for the benefit of those beneficiaries on into the future, and they don't get the money back.
All right, Ann, thanks for your call today. Let's go back to the phones. A call from Gulfport. Rose is on the line. Rose, go ahead.
Yes, sir. I'm calling to ask a question about me and my husband. We've been married 31 years, and we've been separated 10 months, and he's a veteran. And I was trying to get some information. What shall I do? What is a good information that I can get some information, you know, because if he passed away or something happened to him, what would happen?
Are you asking about veterans' benefits?
Yes.
Veterans who even don't have service-connected disabilities may be eligible for veterans' benefits, called the veterans' pension. And it depends on their assets. The veterans' benefit rules for pension payments have a countable asset limit of around $80,000 for a couple, or in some places around $50,000 for an individual veteran. If y'all have assets that are less than those amounts and you've got some income, you'd have to talk to somebody at the veterans office. Every county in Mississippi has a veterans services office, a VSO.
A veteran service office, what would that be down here?
It would be, you can go to the Board of Supervisors or the Chancery Clerk's office, and they can tell you, because those offices are generally housed in the courthouse in the county. But every county has a veteran services officer who can help constituents in that county process those applications. And so they're supposed to know pretty much those rules, and that's where I suggest you would go, if not, you know, find somebody that can lead you to somebody with the veterans office that can help you.
All right, Rose, appreciate your call on Money Talks today. We're about to wrap things up, but Rick, maybe if we could kind of do a little bit of reviewing. I thought at the beginning was good what you were talking about. If when you're talking about estate planning, it's a good idea to kind of figure out what you are trying to get out of it in terms of things. So what, like, who are you trying to protect? That's so on. What are some questions that people should have in their mind as they think about estate planning?
Well, they should be asking, what do I have to protect?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, first of all, is it money assets or is it some land that the family has passed down for generations? There are different dynamics that you would apply to each of those two different types of assets. Then, who am I trying to protect? Am I trying to protect myself from creditor attacks? Think about the exemptions. Think about trusts as a way to protect assets. Trusts are very helpful in asset protection law. Am I trying to protect my spouse and children, or am I trying to protect family members from problems. Like if I leave my son an inheritance or make a gift, his creditors and predators are going to take it away. So I'll do something different. I'll put it in a trust for him so they can't get it, and the trustee will dole it out for him. And then what am I trying to protect things from? Is it long-term care? Well, we've talked about Medicaid a little bit and the planning. And a lot of times, again, if mom or dad are saying, I want to protect myself from the cost of long-term care, are you really trying to protect your children from paying for your long-term care? Is that really the question that's behind that? Well, yeah, I guess that is it. Well, then if you pay your way with your assets, you're protecting them from paying your cost of care.
Which brings up the question, Rick, should everyone have long-term care insurance?
Nothing is good for everyone, but lots of things are good for lots of people. I tell folks, long-term care insurance is a good way to protect your financial assets from the costs of long-term care if you can afford it when you buy it and can continue to afford it in the future, even if your income goes down in retirement, because the premiums don't go down.
Right.
But you can get some coverage and buy some coverage that would pay the nursing home, and so your assets would not have to be used to do that.
I'd like to thank Rick Courtney for being with us today on Money Talks. His website is elderlawms.com, and there's a link to that on our webpage, mpbonline.org. So if you need information from Rick, go to his website, elderlawms.com, or go to our website, mpbonline.org. Money Talks is a production of MPB Think Radio, funded in part by the Foundation for Public Broadcasting in Mississippi and listeners like you. Thanks to our producer and call screener today, Ezra Wall. For Nancy Lottridge Anderson and Chris Burford, I'm Kevin Farrell. Again, thanking Rick Courtney for being with us today. Be sure to tune in at 9 tomorrow. There'll be Southern Remedy. And then you can join us again next Tuesday at 9 for another Money Talks right here and only on MPB Think Radio.
This is an MPB Think Radio podcast. MPBOnline.org. MPB Think Radio.